The Flimsy, 16, Mother's Death and the Amulet, curtains parted and I saw the beloved form of my mother. Awaken your father. Her voice was only a whisper. Take the first available train, at 4 o'clock this morning. Rush to Calcutta if you would see me. The wraith-like figure vanished. Father, father, mother is dying. The terror in my tone aroused him instantly. I sobbed out the fatal tidings. Never mind that hallucination of yours. Father gave his characteristic negation to a new situation. Your mother is in excellent health. If we get any bad news, we shall leave tomorrow. You shall never forgive yourself for not starting now. Anguish caused me to add bitterly, nor shall I ever forgive you. The melancholy morning came with explicit words. Mother dangerously ill, marriage postponed, come at once. Father and I left distractedly. One of my uncles met us en route at a transfer point. A train thundered toward us, looming with telescopic increase. From my inner tumult, an abrupt determination rose to hurl myself on the railroad tracks. Already bereft, I felt, of my mother, I could not endure a world suddenly barren to the bone. I loved mother as my dearest friend on earth. Her solacing black eyes had been my surest refuge in the trifling tragedies of childhood. Does she yet live? I stopped for one last question to my uncle. Of course she is alive. He was not slow to interpret the desperation in my face. But I scarcely believed him. When we reached our Calcutta home, it was only to confront the stunning mystery of death. I collapsed into an almost lifeless state. Years passed before any reconciliation entered my heart. Storming the very gates of heaven, my cries at last summoned the Divine Mother. Her words brought final healing to my suppurating wounds. It is I who have watched over thee, life after life, in the tenderness of many mothers. See in my gaze the two black eyes, the lost beautiful eyes, thou seekest. Father and I returned to Bailey soon after the crematory rites for the well-beloved. Early every morning I made a pathetic memorial pilgrimage to a large shealy tree which shaded the smooth, green-gold lawn before our bungalow. In poetical moments, I thought that the white shealy flowers were strewing themselves with a willing devotion over the grassy altar. Mingling tears with the dew, I often observed a strange otherworldly light emerging from the dawn. Intense pangs of longing for God assailed me. I felt powerfully drawn to the Himalayas. One of my cousins, fresh from a period of travel in the Holy Hills, visited us in Bailey. I listened eagerly to his tales about the high mountain abode of yogis and swamis. Let us run away to the Himalayas. My suggestion one day to Dwarka Prasat, the young son of our landlord in Bailey, fell on unsympathetic ears. He revealed my plan to my elder brother, who had just arrived to see father. Instead of laughing lightly over this impractical scheme of a small boy, Ananta made it a definite point to ridicule me. Where is your orange robe? You can't be a swami without that. But I was inexplicably thrilled by his words. They brought a clear picture of myself roaming about India as a monk. Perhaps they awakened memories of a past life. In any case, I began to see with what natural ease I would wear the garb of that anciently founded monastic order. Chatting one morning with Dwarka, I felt a love for God descending with avalanchic force. My companion was only partly attentive to the ensuing eloquence, but I was wholeheartedly listening to myself. I fled that afternoon toward Nainital in the Himalayan foothills. Ananta gave determined chase. I was forced to return sadly to Bailey. The only pilgrimage permitted me was the customary one at dawn to the Shili tree. My heart wept for the lost mothers, human and divine. The rent left in the family fabric by mother's death was irreparable. Father never remarried during his nearly 40 remaining years. Assuming the difficult role of father-mother to his little flock, he grew noticeably more tender, more approachable. With calmness and insight, he solved the various family problems. After office hours he retired like a hermit to the cell of his room, practicing Kriya Yoga in a sweet serenity. Long after mother's death, I attempted to engage an English nurse to attend to details that would make my parents' life more comfortable. But father shook his head. Service to me ended with your mother. His eyes were remote with a lifelong devotion. I will not accept ministrations from any other woman. 14 months after mother's passing, I learned that she had left me a momentous message. Ananta was present at her deathbed and had recorded her words. Although she had asked that the disclosure be made to me in 1 year, my brother delayed. He was soon to leave Bareilly for Calcutta, to marry the girl mother had chosen for him. One evening he summoned me to his side. Mukunda, I have been reluctant to give you strange tidings. Ananta's tone held a note of resignation. My fear was to inflame your desire to leave home. But in any case you are bristling with divine ardor. When I captured you recently on your way to the Himalayas, I came to a definite resolve. I must not further postpone the fulfillment of my solemn promise. My brother handed me a small box, and delivered mother's message. Let these words be my final blessing, my beloved son Mukunda. Mother had said. The hour is here when I must relate a number of phenomenal events following your birth. I first knew your destined path when you were but a babe in my arms. I carried you then to the home of my guru in Benares. Almost hidden behind a throng of disciples, I could barely see Lahiri Mahasaya as he sat in deep meditation. While I patted you, I was praying that the great guru take notice and bestow a blessing. As my silent devotional demand grew in intensity, he opened his eyes and beckoned me to approach. The others made a way for me. I bowed at their sacred feet. My master seated you on his lap, placing his hand on your forehead by way of spiritually baptizing you. Little mother, thy son will be a yogi. As a spiritual engine, he will carry many souls to God's kingdom. My heart leapt with joy to find my secret prayer granted by the omniscient guru. Shortly before your birth, he had told me you would follow his path. Later, my son, your vision of the great light was known to me and your sister Oma, as from the next room we observed you motionless on the bed. Your little face was illuminated, your voice rang with iron resolve as you spoke of going to the Himalayas in quest of the divine. In these ways, dear son, I came to know that your road lies far from worldly ambitions. The most singular event in my life brought further confirmation, an event which now impels my deathbed message. It was an interview with a sage in the Punjab. While our family was living in Lahore, one morning the servant came precipitantly into my room. Mistress, a strange sadhu is here. He insists that he see the mother of Mukunda. These simple words struck a profound chord within me. I went at once to greet the visitor. Bowing at his feet, I sensed that before me was a true man of God. Mother, he said, the great masters wish you to know that your stay on earth will not be long. Your next illness shall prove to be your last. There was a silence, during which I felt no alarm but only a vibration of great peace. Finally he addressed me again, you are to be the custodian of a certain silver amulet. I will not give it to you today, to demonstrate the truth in my words, the talisman shall materialize in your hands tomorrow as you meditate. On your deathbed, you must instruct your eldest son Ananta to keep the amulet for 1 year and then to hand it over to your second son. Mukunda will understand the meaning of the talisman from the great ones. He should receive it about the time he is ready to renounce all worldly hopes and start his vital search for God. When he has retained the amulet for some years, and when it has served its purpose, it shall vanish. Even if kept in the most secret spot, it shall return whence it came. I proffered alms to the saint, and bowed before him in great reverence. Not taking the offering, he departed with a blessing. The next evening, as I sat with folded hands in meditation, a silver amulet materialized between my palms, even as the sadhu had promised. It made itself known by a cold, smooth touch. I have jealously guarded it for more than 2 years, and now leave it in Ananta's keeping. Do not grieve for me, as I shall have been ushered by my great guru into the arms of the infinite. Farewell, my child, the cosmic mother will protect you. A blaze of illumination came over me with possession of the amulet, many dormant memories awakened. The talisman, round and anciently quaint, was covered with Sanskrit characters. I understood that it came from teachers of past lives, who were invisibly guiding my steps. A further significance there was, indeed, but one does not reveal fully the heart of an amulet. How the talisman finally vanished amidst deeply unhappy circumstances of my life, and how its loss was a herald of my gain of a guru, cannot be told in this chapter. But the small boy, thwarted in his attempts to reach the Himalayas, daily traveled far on the wings of his amulet. Chapter 3. The Saint with Two Bodies. My keen love of travel was seldom hindered by father. He permitted me, even as a mere boy, to visit many cities and pilgrimage spots. Usually one or more of my friends accompanied me. We would travel comfortably on first-class passes provided by father. His position as a railroad official was fully satisfactory to the nomads in the family. Father promised to give my request due consideration. The next day he summoned me and held out a round-trip pass from Bali to Benares, a number of rupee notes, and two letters. I have a business matter to propose to a Benares friend, Kedarnath Babu. Unfortunately, I have lost his address. But I believe you will be able to get this letter to him through our common friend, Swami Pranabananda. The Swami, my brother disciple, has attained an exalted spiritual stature. You will benefit by his company. This second note will serve as your introduction. Father's eyes twinkled as he added, "Mind, no more flights from home." I set forth with the zest of my 12 years, though time has never dimmed my delight in new scenes and strange faces. Reaching Benares, I proceeded immediately to the Swami's residence. The front door was open. I made my way to a long, hall-like room on the second floor. A rather stout man, wearing only a loincloth, was seated in lotus posture on a slightly raised platform. His head and unwrinkled face were clean shaven, a beatific smile played about his lips. To dispel my thought that I had intruded, he greeted me as an old friend. "Babu Anand, bliss to my dear one." His welcome was given heartily in a childlike voice. I knelt and touched his feet. "Are you Swami Pranabananda?" He nodded. "Are you Bhagabati's son?" His words were out before I had had time to get father's letter from my pocket. In astonishment, I handed him the note of introduction, which now seems superfluous. "Of course I will locate Kedarnath Babu for you." The saint again surprised me by his clairvoyance. He glanced at the letter, and made a few affectionate references to my parent. "You know, I am enjoying two pensions. One is by the recommendation of your father, for whom I once worked in the railroad office. The other is by the recommendation of my heavenly father, for whom I have conscientiously finished my earthly duties in life." I found this remark very obscure. "What kind of pension, sir, do you receive from the heavenly father? Does he drop money in your lap?" He laughed. "I mean a pension of fathomless peace, a reward for many years of deep meditation. I never crave money now. My few material needs are amply provided for. Later you will understand the significance of a second pension." Abruptly terminating our conversation, the saint became gravely motionless. A sphinx-like air enveloped him. At first his eyes sparkled, as if observing something of interest, then grew dull. I felt abashed at his poor soliloquy. He had not yet told me how I could meet father's friend. A trifle restlessly, I looked about me in the bare room, empty except for us two. My idle gaze took in his wooden sandals, lying under the platform seat. "Little sir, don't get worried. The man you wish to see will be with you in half an hour." The yogi was reading my mind, a feat not too difficult at the moment. Again he fell into inscrutable silence. My watch informed me that 30 minutes had elapsed. The Swami aroused himself. "I think Kedarnath Babu is nearing the door. I heard somebody coming up the stairs." An amazed incomprehension arose suddenly. My thoughts raced in confusion. How is it possible that father's friend has been summoned to this place without the help of a messenger? The Swami has spoken to no one but myself since my arrival. Abruptly I quitted the room and descended the steps. Halfway down I met a thin, fair-skinned man of medium height. He appeared to be in a hurry. Are you Kedarnath Babu? Excitement colored my voice. Yes. Are you not Bhagabati's son who has been waiting here to meet me? He smiled in friendly fashion. Sir, how do you happen to come here? I felt baffled resentment over his inexplicable presence. Everything is mysterious today. Less than an hour ago I had just finished my bath in the Ganges when Swami Prainabhanandu approached me. I have no idea how he knew I was there at that time. Bhagabati's son is waiting for you in my apartment, he said. Will you come with me? I gladly agreed. As we proceeded hand in hand, the Swami in his wooden sandals was strangely able to outpace me, though I wore these stout walking shoes. How long will it take you to reach my place? Prainabhanandaji suddenly halted to ask me this question. About half an hour. I have something else to do at present. He gave me an enigmatical glance. I must leave you behind. You can join me in my house, where Bhagabati's son and I will be awaiting you. Before I could remonstrate, he dashed swiftly past me and disappeared in the crowd. I walked here as fast as possible. This explanation only increased my bewilderment. I inquired how long he had known the Swami. We met a few times last year, but not recently. I was very glad to see him again today at the bathing ghat. I cannot believe my ears. Am I losing my mind? Did you meet him in a vision, or did you actually see him, touch his hand, and hear the sound of his feet? I don't know what you're driving at. He flushed angrily. I am not lying to you. Can't you understand that only through the Swami could I have known you were waiting at this place for me? Why, that man, Swami Prainabhananda, has not left my sight a moment since I first came about an hour ago. I blurted out the whole story. His eyes opened widely. Are we living in this material age, or are we dreaming? I never expected to witness such a miracle in my life. I thought this Swami was just an ordinary man, and now I find he can materialize an extra body and work through it. Together we entered the saint's room. Look, those are the very sandals he was wearing at the ghat, Kedarnath Babu whispered. He was clad only in a loincloth, just as I see him now. As the visitor bowed before him, the saint turned to me with a quizzical smile. Why are you stupefied at all this? The subtle unity of the phenomenal world is not hidden from true yogis. I instantly see and converse with my disciples in distant Calcutta. They can similarly transcend at will every obstacle of gross matter. It was probably in an effort to stir spiritual ardor in my young breast that the Swami had condescended to tell me of his powers of astral radio and television. But instead of enthusiasm, I experienced only an awe-stricken fear. Inasmuch as I was destined to undertake my divine search through one particular guru, Sri Yukteswar, whom I had not yet met, I felt no inclination to accept Prainabhanandu as my teacher. I glanced at him doubtfully, wondering if it were he or his counterpart before me. The master sought to banish my disquietude by bestowing a soul-awakening gaze, and by some inspiring words about his guru. Lahiri Mahasaya was the greatest yogi I ever knew. He was divinity itself in the form of flesh. If a disciple, I reflected, could materialize an extra fleshly form at will, what miracles indeed could be barred to his master? I will tell you how priceless is a guru's help. I used to meditate with another disciple for 8 hours every night. We had to work at the railroad office during the day. Finding difficulty in carrying on my clerical duties, I desired to devote my whole time to God. For 8 years I persevered, meditating half the night. I had wonderful results. Tremendous spiritual perceptions illumined my mind, but a little veil always remained between me and the infinite. Even with superhuman earnestness, I found the final irrevocable union to be denied me. One evening I paid a visit to Lahiri Mahasaya and pleaded for his divine intercession. My importunities continued during the entire night. Angelic Guru, my spiritual anguish is such that I can no longer bear my life without meeting the Great Beloved face to face. What can I do? You must meditate more profoundly. I am appealing to Thee, O God my Master. I see Thee materialized before me in a physical body, bless me that I may perceive thee in thine infinite form. Lahiri Mahasaya extended his hand in a benign gesture. You may go now and meditate. I have interceded for you with Brahma. Immeasurably uplifted, I returned to my home. In meditation that night, the burning goal of my life was achieved. Now I ceaselessly enjoy the spiritual pension. Never from that day has the blissful Creator remained hidden from my eyes behind any screen of delusion. Prajnabhananda's face was suffused with divine light. The peace of another world entered my heart, all fear had fled. The saint made a further confidence. Some months later I returned to Lahiri Mahasaya and tried to thank him for his bestowal of the infinite gift. Then I mentioned another matter. Divine Guru, I can no longer work in the office. Please release me. Brahma keeps me continuously intoxicated. Apply for a pension from your company. What reason shall I give, so early in my service? Say what you feel. The next day I made my application. The doctor inquired the grounds for my premature request. At work, I find an overpowering sensation rising in my spine. It permeates my whole body, unfitting me for the performance of my duties. Without further questioning, the physician recommended me highly for a pension, which I soon received. I know the divine will of Lahiri Mahasaya worked through the doctor and the railroad officials, including your father. Automatically they obeyed the great Guru's spiritual direction, and freed me for a life of unbroken communion with the beloved. After this extraordinary revelation, Swami Prajnabhananda retired into one of his long silences. As I was taking leave, touching his feet reverently, he gave me his blessing. Your life belongs to the path of renunciation and yoga. I shall see you again, with your father, later on. The years brought fulfillment to both these predictions. Kedarnath Babu walked by my side in the gathering darkness. I delivered father's letter, which my companion read under a street lamp. Your father suggests that I take a position in the Calcutta office of his railroad company. How pleasant to look forward to at least one of the pensions that Swami Prajnabhananda enjoys. But it is impossible, I cannot leave Benares. Alas, two bodies are not yet for me. Chapter 4. My interrupted flight toward the Himalayas. These were my final instructions to Amarmita, a high school friend who planned to accompany me to the Himalayas. We had chosen the following day for our flight. Precautions were necessary, as Anantu exercised a vigilant eye. He was determined to foil the plans of escape which he suspected were uppermost in my mind. The amulet, like a spiritual yeast, was silently at work within me. Amidst the Himalayan snows, I hoped to find the master whose face often appeared to me in visions. The family was living now in Calcutta, where father had been permanently transferred. Following the patriarchal Indian custom, Ananta had brought his bride to live in our home. Now at 4 Gupta Road, there in a small attic room I engaged in daily meditations and prepared my mind for the divine search. The memorable morning arrived with inauspicious rain. Hearing the wheels of MR's carriage in the road, I hastily tied together a blanket, a pair of sandals, Lahiri Mahasaya's picture, a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, a string of prayer beads, and two loincloths. This bundle I threw from my third-story window. I ran down the steps and past my uncle, buying fish at the door. What is the excitement? His gaze roved suspiciously over my person. I gave him a non-committal smile and walked to the lane. Retrieving my bundle, I joined MR with conspiratorial caution. We drove to Chandni Chowk, a merchandise center. For months we had been saving our tiffin money to buy English clothes. Knowing that my clever brother could easily play the part of a detective, we thought to outwit him by European garb. On the way to the station, we stopped for my cousin, Jotin Ghosh, whom I called Jatinder. He was a new convert, longing for a guru in the Himalayas. He donned the new suit we had in readiness. Well camouflaged, we hoped. A deep elation possessed our hearts. All we need now are canvas shoes. I led my companions to a shop displaying rubber-soled footwear. Articles of leather, gotten only through the slaughter of animals, must be absent on this holy trip. I halted on the street to remove the leather cover from my Bhagavad Gita, and the leather straps from my English-made solar topi helmet. At the station we bought tickets to Burdwan, where we planned to transfer for Haridwar in the Himalayan foothills. As soon as the train, like ourselves, was in flight, I gave utterance to a few of my glorious anticipations. Just imagine, I ejaculated. We shall be initiated by the masters and experience the trance of cosmic consciousness. Our flesh will be charged with such magnetism that wild animals of the Himalayas will come tamely near us. Tigers will be no more than meek house cats awaiting our caresses. This remark, picturing a prospect I considered entrancing, both metaphorically and literally, brought an enthusiastic smile from Amar. But Jatinder averted his gaze, directing it through the window at the scampering landscape. Let the money be divided in three portions. Jatinder broke a long silence with this suggestion. Each of us should buy his own ticket at Burdwan. Thus no one at the station will surmise that we are running away together. I unsuspectingly agreed. At dusk our train stopped at Burdwan. Jatinder entered the ticket office, Amar and I sat on the platform. We waited 15 minutes, then made unavailing inquiries. Searching in all directions, we shouted Jatinder's flight toward the Himalayas, name with the urgency of fright. But he had faded into the dark unknown surrounding the little station. I was completely unnerved, shocked to a peculiar numbness. That God would countenance this depressing episode. The romantic occasion of my first carefully planned flight after him was cruelly marred. Amar, we must return home. I was weeping like a child. Jatinder's callous departure is an ill omen. This trip is doomed to failure. Is this your love for the Lord? Can't you stand the little test of a treacherous companion? Through Amar's suggestion of a divine test, my heart steadied itself. We refreshed ourselves with famous Burdwan sweetmeats, Saitobhog, food for the goddess, and Motichur nuggets of sweet pearl. In a few hours, we entrained for Haridwar, via Bareilly. Changing trains at Mogyal Serai, we discussed a vital matter as we waited on the platform. Amar, we may soon be closely questioned by railroad officials. I am not underrating my brother's ingenuity. No matter what the outcome, I will not speak untruth. All I ask of you, Mukunda, is to keep still. Don't laugh or grin while I am talking. At this moment, a European station agent accosted me. He waved a telegram whose import I immediately grasped. Are you running away from home in anger? No. I was glad his choice of words permitted me to make emphatic reply. Not anger but divinest melancholy was responsible, I knew, for my unconventional behavior. The official then turned to Amar. The duel of wits that followed hardly permitted me to maintain the council's stoic gravity. Where is the third boy? The man injected a full ring of authority into his voice. Come on, speak the truth. Sir, I notice you are wearing eyeglasses. Can't you see that we are only two? Amar smiled impudently. I am not a magician, I can't conjure up a third companion. The official, noticeably disconcerted by this impertinence, sought a new field of attack. What is your name? I am called Thomas. I am the son of an English mother and a converted Christian Indian father. What is your friend's name? I call him Thompson. By this time, my inward mirth had reached a zenith. I unceremoniously made for the train, whistling for departure. Amar followed with the official, who was credulous and obliging enough to put us into a European compartment. It evidently pained him to think of two half-English boys traveling in the section allotted to natives. After his polite exit, I lay back on the seat and laughed uncontrollably. My friend wore an expression of blithe satisfaction at having outwitted a veteran European official. On the platform I had contrived to read the telegram. From my brother, it went thus, three Bengali boys in English clothes running away from home toward Haridwar via Mogyal Serai. Please detain them until my arrival. Ample reward for your services. Amar, I told you not to leave marked timetables in your home. My glance was reproachful. Brother must have found one there. My friend sheepishly acknowledged the thrust. We halted briefly in Bailey, where Dwarka Prasad awaited us with a telegram from Ananta.